Hi ADHD mums, let's talk about something that so many of us go through, finally realizing that maybe, just maybe, your brain has been playing by a completely different rule book this whole time. Maybe you've always been forgetful, distracted, overwhelmed by basic life admin. Or maybe you're go, 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 bouncing between hyperfocus, starting projects at 11 o'clock at night, running on pure adrenaline until you crash and then you can't get out of bed. The truth is, ADHD is not one thing, and knowing how it actually shows up for you is the key to making life easier. That's exactly why I created the ADHD Pre-Diagnosis Workbook, a guide that's made specifically for women and mothers navigating through this process. Before you even set foot in the psychiatrist's office, this workbook helps you figure out 1. What type of ADHD you most align with, hyperactive, inattentive, or a mix of both. 2. How ADHD uniquely impacts your daily life, emotions, and parenting. 3. The strategies that actually work for your brain, so you can start making changes today. Because here's the thing, ADHD in women often looks different from the classic stereotype. If you're ready to get clarity on what's going on with your brain and walk through your diagnosis or self-understanding, feeling empowered instead of lost, grab a copy of the ADHD Pre-Diagnosis Workbook now on ADHDmums.com.au, because knowing your ADHD is the first step to working with it, not against it. Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. Today we have another interview with one of the most requested return guests. Who is it? Claire Britton. How are you, Claire?
Well, I am good, thank you. A bit chaotic, but good. What about you, Jane?
I am the same. I actually was like running around half crying earlier looking for a computer charger. And it's just been a complete mess. And it's only 7 a.m. there, Claire, hey?
We're 3 hours behind you, I think.
I love the optimistic Claire from the past who booked that in.
Yeah.
Considering you've got 2 kids under 3.
5, so it's basically lunchtime. That's okay. So,
you've had, 6 hours of broken sleep?
That's it. Exactly. Early parenthood life.
That's all you need.
Yeah.
Really. It's all you need to lose your biscuits. Okay, so for anyone who doesn't remember Claire's previous episodes, well, firstly, you're missing out. Claire has done 2 other episodes. Claire's executive function episode is one of the most popular, and the evidence-based strategies one is very good as well, but particularly the executive function one has had a really, really high download. One of the reasons I think it was because she actually went into what executive function is instead of just throwing the word around, which we all tend to, but we actually don't know what it means. So that is a great episode to listen to. I'll put both in the show notes. Claire is an OT from Perth. She runs Neuro Inclusion. I'm going to put all of her website and her details in there. Claire is a mum with 2 children as well. She's got 2 young children. She's neurodiverse yourself, aren't you, Claire?
Yes, I'm neurodivergent. Yep.
Just making sure that no one here thinks we've got a random neurotypical person that's about to talk to us about Arfin. So Claire, one of the biggest hot topics we have is Arfin. So whenever I post about it on my stories, I just get so many replies. And over the Christmas break, I really got to a crisis level with 2 of my kids where I was like, right, I've just got to get on this. And then from that, there has been so much asking questions and outpour from the community. I don't have the expertise to even get into Arfin because I am battling it myself with my 2 children. We have an episode coming up with Margot, who you very generously pointed out would be a great person for a clinical perspective. So that episode is coming out next week after this one is out. So this episode is going to be about, you know, the personal journey, and then we'll do the clinical stuff with Margot next week.
Yeah, it's so interesting because obviously my previous podcast episodes with you have been me being the clinician, and so I feel a lot more comfortable being the therapist and being the clinician. And so talking about my own challenges and my own differences is quite unnerving. And I think a lot of neurodivergent people, especially that work in, say, the teaching or therapy spaces where we look after other people, we're really good at supporting other people with our challenges. But when it becomes about us, it's actually really hard. And we see that even with parenting, like we can support our kids with it. But then when we reflect on actually that an issue or a difference that I experienced too, we realize that it's actually really hard to put ourselves out there and actually get ourselves the support and the acknowledgement of some of our challenges.
Oh, absolutely. I love hearing from neurodivergent adults about what could have been handled differently or better by parents back in the day when no one knew what anything was. People didn't know what depression was. So it's a conversation that your parents wouldn't have known any better anyway, regardless of how hard they tried. But it's great to hear from an adult, because when you're looking at a child and you haven't experienced it yourself, I don't think I've experienced it myself. However, in saying that, I did have quite a significant eating disorder for a long period of time, and I'm autistic. So, you know, whether I actually did, who knows? I might discover from this conversation, maybe I did. But so what was it like for you growing up with Arford?
So I grew up in a very neurodivergent family. So it was just part of our normal culture. I didn't really see it as anything different. You know, we had pasta 4 to 5 nights a week, and that was just stock standard. You know, we didn't really choose what was for dinner. My mom was the big cook, and so she would cook the meals based on what majority would eat, and pasta was our safe food. So if in doubt, we're having pasta. And as I got older and started to, you know, go to other people's houses, it was like, oh, you don't have pasta for dinner? And that realization that if I'm having pasta so frequently, I was obviously then missing out on other different types of foods and things like that.
So you don't have to name them, but did you have siblings as well?
Yeah, my brother and my sister are younger than me, and same. So we all just ate the same foods, and it was just completely normal.
So you had 5 people eating the same repetitive pasta, and it was the safe food for all 5 of you. So that was just lucky. Like, oh, that works out. Everyone's happy with pasta. The same recipes, or?
Majority was the same, like, spaghetti bolognese recipe. If there was a slight change in, say, like, the amount of herbs that went into it, we just would touch it. So any slight variation in terms of the texture or in terms of how the vegetables was chopped into the pasta sauce, that would instantly be, we just didn't eat it. But I very much grew up, like a lot of us, in that household where you ate what you were given, and that not eating was like a sign of like disrespect to the cook and disrespect to the family. So if we didn't like what was prepared, it was tough luck. You were going to sit there and you're going to eat. And it created quite a stressful situation around mealtimes. And it was probably one of the only times that we all would sit together as a family as well. We all had to eat it. And because of that routine, a lot of difficult conversations became associated with mealtimes. So if there was a particular challenge, say, you know, someone didn't get a good grade on a test, that would be brought up during the mealtime because you had everyone there, and the expectation was everyone was there for the duration of the meal. So you very much felt trapped. So it very much became mealtimes, food was a very high, intense, stressful situation where you had to eat everything regardless of how you felt about it. And then there was also challenges around what was expected socially and the questioning that was provided and the setup around, you know, you had to remain seated and you had to engage in conversations that sometimes weren't ideal or best, I don't know, even just more common, I guess. Like looking back, every time I would have someone come over, they would be like, wow, that meal was, I've never had anything like that. It's just like a whole different world. Now in hindsight, I'm like, yep, that makes sense. But at the time I always thought, oh, really? Like, I don't understand. But often like my mom and my brother would bring like quite a controversial topic, and they would have studied the topic. So they felt very prepared and knowledgeable about it. And they would pretty much info dump, and we would all kind of argue. And like, it was just these massive, big topics. And you'd just sit there and just be bombarded, not just verbal information, but like controversial topics and emotions and pressure. It just kind of created a concoction of stress for me personally. So now, being someone who I now don't have that connection with my family, it's really interesting navigating mealtimes now that they are stressless and they're respectful and they're calm and it's very polite. Like my husband's British. So whilst they still have that high value of mealtime being a time that everyone comes and sits together, they're very British in the sense that you don't bring up big topics during mealtimes.
So how would then Arford play out? Like, was it more around when you would leave the family home, go to a different house, you'd be like, oh my God, this isn't pasta? Or would it be like, okay, mum's put some zucchini in this, that was unexpected, now I have to sit here and eat it even though I don't want to?
Yeah, so I remember being 14, and at the time I was living in Melbourne, and I had just started doing things on my own because I was, you know, big kid, teenager, loving life. and I were going into the city with some friends and we went to Boost Juice and my brain just exploded because I was like, how did they put mango and apple in a liquid? Like, I just had never even heard of that, let alone seen it. I never thought to combine fruits. Every time I've eaten food, I always eat them separately. So it looks like I'm eating all of it. So from like a quick glance, yeah, Claire's a great eater. But if you actually watch how I eat, I'm eating, you know, all of the carrot first and then I'm eating all of, so it's very broken down because I don't like mixing of texture, which is part of that sensitivity as part of being autistic. But I just flew under the radar because I ate everything. So there's no problem. But the idea of a Boost Juice having mixed flavors and mixed everything just completely shocked my nervous system. And I can vividly stand in that Boost Juice store where my friends are happy ordering stuff. And they were like, what about you, Claire? And I just died. I was like, how do I even understand what this is? I don't know what texture this is going to be, what flavor this is going to be, what color is it? Like, if you mix mango and apple, like, is that going to be an orange? I can't even visualize what that would look like. And that actually triggered my nervous system to go into like a full state of panic, which I had no expectation that that would be the case. And so it's fascinating that that was probably the most key standout first impression that I had of that moment. But for me, it wasn't until I moved out of home at 22 that I realized like people can go to like different restaurants at different times for different kinds of food. Because we always went to the same restaurants, you know, we're autistic, we're very rigid, it's just part of our routine. And looking back, I'm like, so many people would have missed that. That's actually such a small detail that neurotypically probably would have even have flinched. And then once I moved out of home, all of my structure and my scaffolding that was supporting all my eating and the culture of the family home was gone. I realized I didn't know how to cook. I didn't know what foods were or how to like mix foods and tolerate a mixing of food. I lived with a housemate at the time and she was quite a good cook, but watching her cook just like made me really nauseous and really overwhelmed. And I started to realize like, oh my gosh, this is an anxiety response. I'm going to need a psychologist to work through this. And so I started with psychology. And interestingly, they didn't pick up autism then until much later. I didn't get diagnosed till 28. But looking back, hindsight is 2020, and it's fascinating because I would go on Tinder, and this was like 2016, and I would find some guy that I think they're good looking. Yeah, we've got something like a common interest. And they would ask me where I would like to go for dinner, but they were complete strangers. So there was no expectation of who they were and their expectation of food. But most of the time I wouldn't do second dates because it wasn't about dating. It was about food exposure. And so about 3 nights a week, I would go to different restaurants and try different foods. And that's what I did for at least, I think probably about 18 months. And it was fascinating to sense how much my body would react. I'd have like a visceral reaction, even though I had set myself up to be at this restaurant. I'd set myself up by looking at the menu. I was so motivated and so determined to try different foods. You know, I hadn't had curry until I was 24. I just didn't even know that that existed. And to sit with those uncomfortable feelings of like, I'm going to be sick, or noticing that like I was really tense. Another one that I get quite a lot is like my jaw lock. Even if I want to chew it, my jaw won't let me chew it, which is really like frustrating and debilitating because it's like, I know that this is food. It wouldn't serve you something that's not edible. Like, not. So why can't I just chew into it? And interestingly enough, that's actually how I met my husband. So he was a Tuesday night dinner guy. And again, I didn't wear makeup. I made absolutely no effort because it was not about dating. It was purely about food therapy. And literally saw him and was like, that's my soulmate. Oh my gosh. You don't meet your soulmate on Tuesday night while you're not wearing makeup and dressed up and, you know, you're just, and I didn't even touch any of my phone because we were chatting so much and we were just so mesmerized by each other and it was amazing. It's so funny how that is actually part of our story. And I still to this day say that he is the absolute best supporter for my relationship because he does all the cooking. I don't cook anything. I'd much rather do the thing that I'm good at and that I love to do rather than spend the spoons on the things that bring me stress. I think you're really good with that too, Jane, right? You're like, why would I clean? I'd much rather get a cleaner and do the stuff that I love.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, my husband and I are both neurodivergent. So when we played the mental game a few years ago, we went through all of the tasks and we were seeing a marriage counsellor at the time because I was like going back to work like full-time plus and he was scaling back because we didn't have any family around. So you have to kind of hedge your bets. We both were running businesses and it was like, okay, Jane's going to run this one because we think it's got more potential, but where is hubby going to be and what's he going to be doing and how can we make this work? At that time, we needed a third party because it was a conversation we'd never had before. And it was at that time the marriage counsellor said, and I just loved it, he said, right, everything has to go into three categories, what Jane's doing, what hubby's doing, and what both of you don't want to do that you can afford to outsource. We couldn't afford to outsource anything at that point, but it was really great because it gave us a really big push around money. It was like, Jane, if you can make an extra this, that will mean that there's someone vacuuming and mopping. And hubby, that means you don't do lawns because he hates doing lawns. And so we kept like putting him into groups like, okay, if we can make this, then both of you can have that off. But we both had to work more, but it was in areas that we loved. And once we started seeing that work, he was working in a gym. So once he could see, if I do two more sessions here, I don't have to mow the lawns. It was like a whole new way of living for us.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And I think that is so key to, it doesn't make sense stereotypical because they're like, why would I work more just to do less at home? Like it takes 5 seconds to, you know, spray a countertop. But that is, for a neurodivergent person, that's not ever a 5 second job.
No, it's absolutely not. And again, I should say with privilege that we were both in our own businesses. There's people that are just like, they can't, they're in a public service job, they're in a full-time employment, there's no areas to move. In that particular situation, we were able to make more money by working more exchange of time. But yeah, I agree with you. Neurotypical people would not think that way.
No. And so I delegated all cooking responsibilities to my husband, which at the time I thought that's great. That's similar to how I grew up. I was never allowed in the kitchen. That was my mum's space. If we went in the kitchen, that was, you know, ideal. We were going to mess it all up. And, you know, that was part of her autism and her rigidity around tidiness and cleanliness. So I've never really been in kitchens. And so when my husband was doing cooking, it was really jarring for our relationship to see how many foods he ate that I didn't eat. And also being British, he very much had the belief that we should eat to show a sign of respect. And I think that's something that I've slowly started to understand better is the cultural implications of food. And that there is such a hand-in-hand relationship with so many milestones, like the wedding. How good is a wedding is really based on how good the food is. How good is a birthday party? It's very rooted in your food. Even just social gathering, someone coming to your house, it's just natural to offer them food. But me not eating that food is often perceived a certain way that actually might not be correct. And that actually was rupturing relationships without even being aware of it. I just wasn't eating because I wasn't hungry, or I wasn't getting the cue that I was even hungry, or I was too busy focused on 3 hours ahead in my mind of all these jobs that I was going to do. So the food that was sitting in front of me in that particular moment just didn't even register. But then I've also forgotten that that's been portrayed or been perceived as I'm being disrespectful or not acknowledging the food that was there. So it's interesting to kind of navigate that.
Oh, that's so interesting. One of the biggest arguments my hubby and I have is his background is more around when you present a meal, he will go all out. He's a lot more extensive with his cooking. It's a lot more prep. Everyone has to, you know, move away for him to get this done. And then at the end of it, he really like enjoys to critique it. So he'll say, should I have put more of this in? Should I have put more of that in? And he'll like critique his own food, which I find really confusing. Because I don't have any idea, right? But I still remember growing up, my mum, she did cook some great things, so full respect, but she cooked some awful stuff too. And I remember her dishing out some stuff. It was like, what is that? And I remember my dad just eating it and going, thank you, mother. Thank you, mother. And like, you would never say it was burnt or there was an issue, it was incredibly disrespectful considering she had spent the time cooking it. So then I would go cook some food for my hubby, having multiple kids and working. And then he would go, should there have been a bit more salt and pepper in there? Oh, would peas have gone better? And I'm just there going, like, I got that done in half an hour with all this shit happening, and now you're going to critique it? It's a great point you've put about cultural, and those are two white Caucasians with the same ethnicity. If you actually put in different cultures as well, that would be a whole nother thing.
Yeah, and obviously then you've got like the money aspect is massive as well. So many families are really in a position where they're just making ends meet. They're just trying to make sure that they're providing food to their families. And then to see that food on the floor, that food not eaten.
Or if I say, get me something else. It's like, but that costs money.
That's it. It's really fascinating diving into some of the research around, you know, when we first have a child in our family, it is such a foundational pillar of what makes a good parent is, are they eating? And that's often started from the moment that we're born. Like, how are they eating? Are they good eaters? Are they bad eaters? There's that language from the start. So without even being aware of it from a long-term perspective, society puts so much emphasis on good and bad being determined around food. And obviously we have, you know, horrific language, like if a baby's not eating food and gaining enough weight, that's failure to thrive. Like, that's such derogatory, triggering terminology that's perceived onto the family. And so naturally as a parent, someone critiquing the food that I'm giving my child, I have such a strong visceral response to, because of that biological component where, you know, our biology is like, you have to feed a child to keep them alive. And for a lot of families, that's really tricky because we have a society that says, you know, we need to make sure we're eating fruit and veggies and less processed is best. And here's all these amazing recipes with bone broth and, you know, all these like very nutrient dense foods that just sound brilliant and probably cost a fair bit of money. But if the kid doesn't eat it, then actually that's not worth the time, the money, the effort to actually present that food to the child. And so families are then at this weird crossroads where they're like, I don't want to get my child another load of Macca's chips. But at the same time, that's the only thing they've eaten in the past 24 hours. And I have to keep them eating to be growing and be sustaining life. And that is more of a priority than eating nutrient-dense food that align with the societal expectations or the thing I saw on Instagram that I'm like, I've saved all these recipes that they just don't even eat.
Oh, totally. Because then you put a starving child and you're like, now they won't do anything. They're so difficult because they haven't eaten for 24 hours or drunk any water. And then, you know, as a parent, like I'm actually in that exact situation with Macca's chips. And it's like, even then it's dicey as to whether it's going to be exactly the same as the other drive-through the other day. But then you're faced with this whole, will they eat eventually? Well, I know the answer for my family is that no, they're not going to eat eventually. So you've actually just got to get them what they'll eat because they will actually not eat anything else.
And that's the difference with ARFID versus fussy eating. So ARFID, you know, having 20 foods or less. And most of the time with people that experience ARFID, we're sensitive to the temperature of the food, we're sensitive to the textures, the flavors, we're really sensitive to the environment that we're eating it in. Sometimes we might eat a food at school where everyone else is eating at the same time, but that same food we won't eat for dinner, or we won't eat that same food at a kid's birthday party. So we're very sensitive to the environment and the societal expectations around food. We're also like really sensitive to our own like emotional regulation in the moment that we eat. So if we were to eat whilst we're stressed about the test tomorrow, chances are we're probably not going to eat the food that, even though it's the safe food and we eat it all the time, that's really high pressure. And so it also creates a lot of anxiety for me as well, in my experience, because especially having young kids, I've often had obviously been pregnant. And when we're pregnant, we know that our taste buds change and our preferences with food changes, which is completely normal. However, being autistic, that change brings a lot of uncertainty, and that is actually really triggering to work through, because all of a sudden my safe foods are no longer my safe food. But what does that mean? What am I actually eating then? Those cookies are not my safe food anymore. Okay, so now what can I eat? And it's really tricky because my husband will cook all these great meals and he'll be like, but you told me this is your favorite chicken. I put the same seasoning as last time. You said it was really good. And yes, I did. But today, I'm really sensitive to the flavor and I just can't eat it. And it's so hard to watch someone you care about and you love feel rejected like that because you want to make them happy. You want to, you know, respect them and honor the amount of time and effort that they've put into making the meal. So I then internalize that. I now feel that every time I eat a meal, I'm constantly feeling conscious of how is this going to be perceived, more so than do I even like it? So it took a lot in adulthood, especially post marriage, figuring out what I actually like and what I want to eat, because so much of the food narrative was scripted for me based on the trauma and the home culture that I had growing up. So it's really interesting that even just the language that we use around food and mealtime become internalized. I feel like we're as a society too, we understand it better with fears and phobias. If a parent is scared of spiders, it's like, yeah, of course, the kids are also going to be scared of spiders. But we haven't applied that same logic to food, that if a family member is more sensitive to that type of food, it makes sense genetically and environmentally that more people are also going to be more sensitive to it as well. It's one of those things that where if you point out a difference, it's really hard to then not notice it.
Let's just say, for example, this child says to me, I will try chicken nuggets, right? So my thought pattern was like, I'm going to get fresh chicken breast. I'm going to make these properly because if I just give him another fast processed food with not even a real meat inside it, that's all he's going to eat forever. So I'm going to give him a proper one. I go make all of this, which I don't enjoy doing, and put it in front of him. He goes, it looks weird. So I try and be so jolly about it, right? But I'm also like dying inside. And then he asks for ham and rice, which is his favorite thing to eat. And I'm like, oh, we're back on ham and rice. You asked for chicken nuggets. I made them. At what point do we go, you have to put some in your mouth?
Yeah. So the research and even just my personal experience is the more that we flip, the more resistance you'll get. So you almost trigger a bit of the PDA if there is any PDA going on. You're going to trigger that. That feels like an external demand. So the moment that we come up with the idea ourselves, like me being like, I'm going to go to all these different restaurants, all these random guys off Tinder, get to these free meals, suddenly my capacity to eat different food, massive. And we see a lot even with adults that go traveling. They'll have a really rigid diet at home and then they go traveling. They're like, yeah, I was eating, you know, different gelato flavors. I was eating all this different food. And they come home and they're like, no, I can't apply that same logic. So, it's really interesting to see how different environment and different choice and control really plays into it. So I think there, it really emphasizes what their idea of chicken nuggets is what we've needed to understand. So the next step potentially is, can you get a picture of what that looks like? So then they are then showing you visually, when I'm thinking chicken nugget, this is what it looks like. Because if it even looks like what I think it looks like, then the visual component of eating food has been ticked, which is a step further than what doesn't happen if you prepare the chicken the way that you think is best. Because if that doesn't align with what I've processed and prepped myself for, that's now a barrier. So sometimes I'll say to families, just ask them to find a picture on the internet, find a video or any sort of concept of what that looks like. I mean, you want to try and match that as best as possible. And then we're getting over the hurdle of visual. Because when we think of Arford especially, we know that sensations are really a foundational contributing factor to how someone eats food or engages with food. So if we can reduce the visual processing that's needed, that's going to help get to the eventual sensation of taste. So there's a feeding therapy approach that's called the SOS feeding approach, and it's sequential oral sensory feeding approach, I think it's called. We can always add stuff like that in the show notes, but there's a really beautiful visual where it's there and the stairs have what you need to tolerate first in order to eat food. So it's really great for that graded approach. you have to tolerate it first, then you have to interact with it. So sometimes that's like preparing the food and putting it in the middle of the table. Like it's not even on their plate, but they're at least interacting in a shared environment with it. So once they're doing that, then naturally they're going to be around the smell of it. So something like curry for me is such a strong smell and I'm very sensitive to smells. So that took a lot of exposure of just interacting around curry before I could even just have it on my plate. And obviously, in order to smell it, typically having it on your own plate, it's directly under your nose. So that helps with that one as well. So it's starting to get used to, I don't have to eat it even though it's on my plate. So it's like toleration component. And then it's just touching it. Do I touch it with a fork? Can I touch it with a spoon? Can I touch it with a chopstick? Can I touch it with my fingers? Can I touch it with my lips? And just exploring touch first. There's some really cool OT activity where they'll chop up different kinds of fruit and get kids to make artwork with it or paint with a tomato. Like it doesn't have to actually be eat the fruit. It's like, let's just paint with some carrot. Then you'll feel the texture of the carrot. You'll feel how hard, how soft cooked carrot is. And that's part of the exploration of food to get to the eventual step of eating. Taste then would come next. Would that be I just licked it or I've just put it against my lips and then eventually eating and swallowing? So it's very much a like gradual approach, which for so many families is really nice to give them a scaffolding and to see why it feels so massive to go from not eating to eating. That just is too big of a jump and they just feel like they hit a wall. And it makes sense because the research says that graded approaches is much better for our nervous system. And we know that if we're feeling much more regulated, we're much more likely to eat. No one eats when we're stressed. In fact, we overeat when we're stressed or we don't eat. That's all or nothing. So making sure that we're regulated before we even provide them the new food or the new food experience.
I think it's a great point, actually. Let's do one more question. This is probably the question I wanted to know the most. As an adult with Arthur, what do you wish your parents knew or understood?
I wish my parents understood that there's no choice involved. It's amazing how just taking away the responsibility of choice reduces the shame, the guilt, the blame, the internalized trauma that I've experienced. I just wish that there was more of a nonchalant response around food and that it was no big deal and they picked up on the fact that it was pressure and it was stressful. So finding moments throughout the day that I was pretty calm and utilizing those as an opportunity to eat or engage with food rather than being like, it's 12 o'clock, it's lunchtime. I don't care that you're in the middle of, you know, hyper-focused game of whatever I was doing as I was younger. It's meal time, so you need to eat. It's really tricky, obviously, as well with school because school has those set eating times. That can also put pressure on us to eat food and feel hungry at a certain time. But our bodies don't really work like that. Our bodies are trying to process so much external information that internal information like hunger cues often get missed. And so that's why after school, all of a sudden you see them devouring so much food because their regulation has finally calmed right back down into, you know, homeostasis where they typically are. And they're like, oh, that tummy pain was actually hunger. That rage I was experiencing, that kid stealing my pencil case wasn't that problematic. It was actually just hunger. But I couldn't process that in the moment because I was in such a heightened state. So I think for parents to really give us the empathy and the patience to ask the questions and really clarify what it means. What food do I wish I ate? Why? Do I feel nervous around certain foods or am I actually really happy eating, you know, pasta 4 nights a week? That was just our normal. It wasn't questioned. What was normal in our household worked because we all ate, we all got the nutrition we needed and everyone ate the same meal. So it was less cognitive load and less expense for everyone else. But as a society, that is seen as not ideal or not best. And so that was the externalizing pressure that fortunately my family was good at ignoring. But it still impacts later in life. So a lot of the food and nutrition talk is all great in theory. And whilst we can acknowledge that foods hold different nutrition and new benefits, at the end of the day, when we're working in the neurodiversity space, we have to acknowledge that different people eat different foods at different times, different ways. And it's more of a collaborative discussion about what works for you rather than this is how we do it.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for your time and your sharing today, Claire. I found that really interesting, but thank you so much for your time and your sharing. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
See you, Claire.
Bye.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.